I'm Paul Vanvis, the host of Curiosity Never Retires, presented by OLLI at American University. OLLI at American University is part of the National OLLI Network that looks to provide retired seniors a chance to study and teach subjects that they've been interested in for years. We offer so many classes in so many subjects that we thought it would help to preview some of them so you can decide which ones to take. If, as we believe, curiosity never retires, and as long as we live, we want to understand how the world works, then few things can help us more than looking back at some of the giants who began to explain it. That is Don Ross's goal in the two courses he's going to teach this fall: Plato's Academic Works and Aristotle's Metaphysics, Psychology, and Epistemology. Thanks for taking the time, Don.
Oh, thank you.
Don, even people untutored in philosophy are probably familiar with the names Plato and Aristotle, two figures of immense importance in early Western civilization. Before we talk about what they believed and wrote, can you give us some sense of their relationship to each other and other ancient philosophers?
Sure. One way to think of ancient philosophy, and this would be everything before the Roman Empire, is you have the first two centuries, say from 600 to 400 roughly, we call it the era of the pre-Socratics, that is to say the philosophers who lived and wrote before Socrates. And then toward the end, you have the Sophists who come in there as well. The pre-Socratics, one of the main questions they had was, what's the fundamental substance, arche, as they call it, the source of everything? Is it water? Is it air? Is it atoms? You know, stuff like that. Also questions about the one and the many. Is everything fundamentally one thing, or is it multiple? Is there change or not? The Sophists, on the other hand, were more interested in human affairs, politics, ethics, religion, art, that sort of thing. So that is the first couple of centuries of ancient philosophy. And then you have the fourth century. And the fourth century is dominated by Plato and Aristotle. Socrates, who was Plato's teacher, wrote nothing. Everything we think we know about Socrates comes either from Xenophon or Plato. But anyway, they really represent the high point of ancient philosophy. The third stage of ancient philosophy is so-called Hellenistic period, after the Macedonian conquest, where the Stoics and the Epicureans were the dominant schools. And for a while, they sort of held forth and eclipsed Plato and Aristotle, but I think the long-term assessment of subsequent ages really says the climax of ancient philosophy occurred in the 4th century BCE with the writings of Plato and Aristotle. They're just fabulous. I mean, fabulous.
Well, is there a difference between the way the two of them approach their common questions of morality and justice and human behavior?
Yes. There are a couple of things that appealed to people, I think, with Plato. But one of the things is the vast vision that he has. I mean, he has this idea that there is an immutable realm of what he calls forms that exist over and above the physical world. There's these political ideals, and also, of course, he's a marvelous writer. I mean, he wrote dialogues, and the greatest of his dialogues, honestly, he's my favorite writer. Not my favorite philosopher, but my favorite writer, because the greatest of his dialogues are so structurally interesting, and he says so much with so little, and they are lively. It's just wonderful. It's a wonderful experience to read Plato. Absolutely wonderful. Plato also admires the Pythagoreans a lot, and the Pythagoreans, remember the Pythagorean theorem, they were mathematically inclined, so that Plato has that, you know, he can check that little box as well. Aristotle, when he was not doing philosophy, was a biologist. He left the academy when Plato died. You know, Aristotle spent 20 years in Plato's academy. But when Plato died, Aristotle left the academy, probably because Plato's successors were emphasizing mathematics to a greater degree. And Aristotle is just more of an empirical scientist. And so he left the academy, went to the Eastern Aegean region, and did a bunch of marine biology there. So that just indicates his proclivities. You know, he's interested in empirical research, and he wrote many works of biology, the history of animals, the progression of animals, the generation of animals, blah, 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 X of animals. So, I mean, he then checks the boxes for a tough-minded thinker. He's absolutely detail-oriented. I mean, he loves details. And the works that we have by Aristotle, he wrote dialogues, but they've all perished, and all we have are fragments, quotations by other authors. But so what we have from Aristotle are his lecture notes, and they are very dry, very detailed, and as I like to say, it's a flat desert. It's a flat landscape. So there are no hills and valleys. It's hard to know what's important and what's of less importance and that sort of thing. You know, Aristotle's just more of a challenge to read. So, I mean, the writing styles are different, and of course, their philosophical orientations are also different. Plato is this wonderful, you know, speculative philosopher. Aristotle is much more matter-of-fact. Let's look at the details. For example, I can give you a really good example, is their politics. Of course, everybody probably has heard of the philosopher king, right? That's Plato's whole deal, right, in the Republic. And Plato has this ideal state where presumably this educational system, you know, weeds out people who are less smart and assigns everybody to the job that they do best. So if you are a crackerjack farmer, whether or not you want to be a farmer, that's tough. You got to be a farmer. The educational system will determine that. But the people who make it all the way to the top are the only people who are deserving to rule in this ideal state. So you have three classes in the ideal state. You have the rulers, the philosopher kings. You have the, what he calls the auxiliaries, who are the enforcers, who listen to what the philosopher kings say and then carry it out. Then you got the workers, who are kind of forced, because if you want to play guitar instead of farming, tough. You don't want an auxiliary knocking at your door in the middle of the night, you know. So they make sure that everybody else does what he or she is best suited to do. And interestingly, beginning of book four of the Republic, Adeimantus, who's one of the people Socrates is talking to, says, gee, are people going to be happy? And Socrates says, my objective is not to make people happy, the citizens happy, it's to make the state happy. And this state, ideal state, is a perfectly organized with everyone doing his or her own work, that it will be in a happy condition, you might say. Well, Aristotle, in his Politics, alludes to Plato's philosopher king, and in a sympathetic way. You know, it's a really great idea. And wouldn't it be great if we found people who were so wise and who always made the right decision and all that sort of thing? Wouldn't it be great if we could? And indeed, yeah, you're right. We could make that person king or queen for life, you know. But then the subtext is, that ain't gonna happen. And so instead, Aristotle launches off in the very next book. This is in book three. In book four of the Politics, he launches off, and he doesn't say this, but what's in the background was either he or his school examined the constitutions, I think it was 158 Greek city-states, because, of course, as you probably know, the Greek city-states were all independent. There's a bazillion of them, and they all had their own peculiar institutions, their own peculiar histories, and that sort of thing. So either he or his school, or both, examined the constitutions of 158 Greek city-states. Aristotle sits back and says, you know, basically, I mean, after all, we do all this empirical written, notice, Plato is expounding a priori. He's saying, my job is to have the most harmonious state, and the most harmonious state can only come about if everybody is doing what that person does best. End of story. But it's all from here, right? So Aristotle goes out, examines 158 different modes of government, and he says, you know, basically what you got are two paradigms out there. Modern translation, right wing or left wing. His words, oligarchy or democracy, right? And you know, there's some good things about oligarchy, some bad things about oligarchy. There's some good things about democracy, some bad things about democracy. So really what you should do is start with whatever you got and try to push it toward the middle realm. So if it's too democratic, you need to push it in an oligarchical direction. If it's too oligarchical, you need to push it in a democratic direction.
You've written that you started out in philosophy when you were an undergrad,
yeah,
as a Platonist.
Yeah.
Because Plato was, as you said, so much easier to read.
Yeah.
But that over the years, you've become an Aristotelian. Yeah. And a large part of that, you said, was because Aristotle helped you become more intellectually and morally mature.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I've explained why Plato is so enjoyable and easier to grasp, because I think I also said that for a long, long time, until almost the time I got my PhD, I was afraid to begin a sentence with the words, Aristotle thought that. And that's because when you read Aristotle, unless you have help, really, you don't know what's first importance, second importance, third importance, because it's just point, 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 and not point, 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 that kind of thing. So you just get lost in the details. I mean, you can't read 100 facts all at the same level and know what in the world's going on. At least I can't. Maybe you can, but I can't. I need some sort of hierarchy. And so when I teach my Aristotle course, I have this 7-layer hierarchy I've developed to try to organize. They're incredibly, you just have no idea how complex it is. I found Aristotle scary almost. I mean, I could have expounded what Berkeley thought and Kant thought and Descartes and Aquinas and Plato and all these people, but I would never begin a sentence with the words Aristotle thought that. It wasn't until late in graduate school that I started getting comfortable with Aristotle, and actually it was teaching that did it. I mean, my first couple of years, I would announce to my class, oh, I'm a Platonist. And I told the story, and what you're talking about, I told the story that maybe this was my third year at University of Maryland or something. I always, because going from Plato, who's so wonderful to read, then to Aristotle, who is so dry, I typically would give my class a pep talk, right? And this third year, I just blurted out, without even thinking, I think it takes more philosophical sophistication to understand Aristotle than to understand Plato. And that is a true statement. That is a true statement. When I talk about maturity versus immaturity, I'm thinking of several things. I'm trying to remember what it was like when I was in my teens and maybe early 20s. And, you know, when you're that age, you don't have that many nuanced ideas in your head. Things tend to be either black or white. You know, there's not a lot of gray out there. The older you get, the more gray there is.
In every sense of the word.
Yes, exactly. Here as well as in here. Teenagers tend to be idealists because there's black and white, right? That sort of thing. And for the longest time, I went along thinking, if something is not mathematically certain in an absolute sense, it's just completely open to question. Well, that's not true, but that's how I thought. You know, it's either this or it's the opposite, and there's nothing in between. That's the attachment to extremes idea. Another characteristic, I think, of immaturity is impatience. You know, you're impatient with the details. You want to have these grand generalizations like Plato does, you know, these grand generalizations, and you just stop. or from a moral perspective, certainly becoming a mature person is to be able to put off gratification, as we say, delay of gratification. And Aristotle has a lot to say about that. He has a lot. Two of his principal moral virtues, courage and temperance, have to do with being able to resist present pains and pleasures for the sake of something more important down the road. He talks about that a lot. And he talks about incontinence and softness, which are sort of the failures to giving in to pleasure, giving in to pain, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah. That's another characteristic of maturity versus immaturity in both the intellectual and the moral spheres. And another thing that comes to mind is you learn to be less self-centered, I think. And it's not just my ideas that are important, but there's a lot of wisdom out there. Well, who is it? Wrote the book many years ago now, The Wisdom of Crowds? Remember that book? I have it at home, never read it, but I have it in the bookcase. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of collective wisdom or social wisdom out there that you need to take seriously. It may not be right, but at least it should have a vote, you know? And Aristotle is sensitive to that. He talks about endoxa, which are common opinions, and they have value. They need to be part of what how you think. But especially from a moral perspective, and I think I said this too, and this is a fact. This is a fact. Nobody has made me feel as guilty as Aristotle. And that's because, well, there are three ideas that kind of go together as I see it in Aristotle. There's the idea of justice, the kaiosune, which he informally defines as another's good. It's the only major moral virtue that's other-directed. You know, courage and temperance are all about me, how I handle pains and pleasures. But justice is all about you, about your good, not my good, your good. Second, epigeia, which is translated usually equity. And that he defines as a corrective to justice, or especially legal justice. You know, when we formulate laws, we do the best we can to come up with laws that are fair and that sort of thing. But sometimes situations come out of left field that nobody ever thought about when the law was formulated. What do we do? Well, equity is a matter of, you might say, adhering to the spirit rather than the letter of the law. You know, you gotta have that. But the other thing that it's just gets me right here, there's another facet to equity. And that is, basically it comes down to cutting people slack. You know, I mean, you may be proven otherwise, it's true, but you should assume the best in people. And if you're nasty to me or whatever, well, maybe you just had a bad day. You're not an evil person. Maybe you just had a bad day. Cut, you know, I need to cut you some slack. Don't be so rigid. You know, this is wrong and you're going to pay for it. You know, so that's another side of equity. And then finally, philia, which is usually translated friendship. But honestly, I am tempted to translate it lovingness, because it derives and is closely associated with the verb philein, which means, it's one of the words meaning to love. And the relationship between philia and dikaiosune, that is to say lovingness, I'm gonna call it, and justice, is that justice operates by rules, whereas philia, lovingness, is like spontaneous justice. In fact, Aristotle says, if you were friends with everybody, which you can't be, that's why we need justice. But if you could be friends with everybody, you wouldn't need justice, because you'd do spontaneously what justice forces you to do
if men by the rules. Angels, there'd be no need for government.
Yeah, that's right. Same idea. So, I mean, and then when I look at myself, I'm just being honest, when I look at myself against those ideals, that just makes me feel guilty. I try, but we're all imperfect, right?
Don, in this brief conversation, relatively brief conversation, you have already opened up for us a vast number of questions and thoughts. So I'm going to ask you to try to make this as short as possible. What do you hope that your students in these two classes will come away with?
I guess every time I teach philosophy, I guess there are two things that I think about. You know, I'm part philosopher, part historian. I'm a cross between the two. So some of it is just factual information. I would like the people coming out of my classes to be able to answer the question or begin a sentence with the words, Aristotle thought that. They certainly have a problem with Plato thought that, but I would hope they could do it for both. And, you know, and say something about the richness of their thought. So that, and that's just purely historical information. But as a philosopher, you need to approach all these people, and I've taught the gamut all the way from ancient to modern, Chinese and Indian. You need to approach them critically. You know, I mean, even Aristotle, I don't agree with 100%, right? And that's your job as a philosopher. I mean, it's great to have these ideas, and it's great to have ideas you disagree with, because it helps to sharpen your own views, because you have to then, if you're a philosopher, you should say, why? Why do I disagree with this? But I will conclude with one little further point. The Ali motto. I was thinking about this on the way over. So the Ali motto is curiosity never retires. I would give that an Aristotelian spin. And I would say it's also the case that the process of intellectual and moral maturation also never retires.
Thank you, Don. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about these courses. I got to sign up. That's all I can say. Curiosity Never Retires is produced by myself, David Flaxman, Andrew Hiller, and Jesse Williams, and is presented by Ali at American University. Our theme music is titled Education Music, and it's from Background Music for Video by Pixabay. You can see our entire fall catalog of courses at olli-dc.org. That's olli-dc.org. For Curiosity Never Retires, I'm Paul Vamlis. Stay curious.